Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. Kristen Bateman for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal. For years, Cash Call and the other defendants told consumers that they owed money that those consumers did not actually owe. That violated the CFPA's prohibition on deceptive practices, and based on the undisputed facts, the District Court agreed and held the defendants liable. Now, for that violation, the Bureau sought a straightforward remedy: restitution of all the interest and fees that the consumers paid that the consumers did not actually owe. But the District Court denied that relief and let Cash Call keep the hundreds of millions of dollars that it collected that it had no right to collect in the first place. That decision was based on erroneous legal principles and should be reversed. And I can talk about that first before turning to the cross-appeal issues challenging.
I do have a question for you. I just want to understand kind of the framing of this case. So the District Court granted summary judgment in favor of the Bureau on the liability of the head guy, right?
The head guy and the companies, yes.
And found that the head guy was reckless, correct?
Correct.
Then there's a bench trial, and the District Court says that there was an insufficient finding of recklessness.
Correct.
So just stop right there.
Sure.
I'm trying to understand why the actions of the CEO, if the CEO was found under, for summary judgment purposes, was found to have been reckless, why isn't that imputed to the corporation? I didn't really understand and didn't see a lot in the briefing discussing this kind of
disconnect.
Yes. Can you help me walk through, am I missing something here?
I'm not sure you're missing something. I have a hard time reconciling those two holdings as well. I think the District Court was absolutely correct to find that Mr. Redham was individually liable at summary judgment because the undisputed facts here show that he was, at a minimum, recklessly indifferent to the truth or falsity of these statements that Cash Call made that consumers owed these amounts. And on appeal now, the defendants are saying, well, no, the undisputed facts didn't show that there's a dispute here, but that is all based on this misconception that recklessness is solely subjective. It's solely about what, as they put it, what Mr. Redham had in his head. But recklessness also includes an objective component. Someone is reckless if they act in the face of an unjustifiably high risk of harm that is either so obvious, that is either known or so obvious that it should be known. And here, the undisputed facts show that at a minimum, Mr. Redham and also Cash Call was either knew the risks or those risks were so obvious that they should be known because counsel had made warnings from the get-go that became increasingly urgent, because state after state after state had brought these regulatory enforcement actions, and because by August or September of 2013, the companies, you know, expressly recognized.
But let me back up a second, though. Did the District Court ever explain why it found summary judgment one way and then all of a sudden something different the next time?
It did not explain that tension in its own rulings. But what it said after the trial on remedies was the thing that it kept emphasizing in its decision, where it ultimately found that the companies were not reckless, kept emphasizing, well, they got counsel, and counsel made all these warnings, but counsel never revoked their opinion, their bottom line opinion that, oh, you know, we have a legal argument here, it's okay, these state laws don't apply, and so consumers owe this money. So once we got to the trial phase, the District Court was putting near dispositive weight on the fact that they got counsel's advice, and counsel gave these opinions and never revoked those opinions.
But just so I'm clear, the recklessness goes to the civil penalties, not to the restitution. Or would you argue it goes to both?
It does not go to the restitution, yeah. Except for Mr. Redham. He can't be liable.
And it is possible that the reckless finding could have applied to the civil penalties at a certain point, meaning just because he was reckless doesn't mean that there was recklessness on day one. It could have crept in. I mean, that seems to be the problem here, is that over time it became increasingly untenable to stick by these legal you know, opinions that he'd gotten.
Right. I do think it became increasingly untenable over time. I would note that at the beginning of our claims cover, our claims began at the end of July of 2011. By August of 2011, there had already been 4 regulatory enforcement actions brought challenging this program. That's the exact number of.
So if we assumed that this recklessness were an error, that he just stuck to tier one in the civil penalties, would we need to go in and say, listen, we actually think it wasn't clear error up to a certain date. I don't know what that would be. So therefore, the district court at least didn't err in imposing tier one penalties for the first, say, 2 years. But for the last 3 years, we think the district court did err, and that should have been tier two. Would we send it back down then? I mean, because the district court could still, there's no mandatory amount. He could order $1 for the, even under tier two. He could award more money under tier one than he does under tier two. So is it, I guess this kind of goes to the same thing. Is it a futile effort to send it back down, or is it important that we say, hey, it was tier one for this period of time and tier two for this period of time?
I do think that it's important, and so what you would do is you would remand it for the district court to impose the appropriate civil penalty within the range, and obviously the recklessness range goes up much higher, and there the district court would have to justify its reasons. Now, obviously the first time around it thought that there were no mitigating factors, that the maximum penalty was warranted, and so, you know, I don't know if it would be open to the district court to suddenly find mitigating factors, but you know, certainly very possible that it would be an abuse of discretion to impose a lower penalty than he has imposed now.
Would the district court be able to go back and revisit what he awarded in the tier one? Meaning if we sort of like agreed that he didn't abuse his discretion for the first 2 years, is he stuck then with the penalty, the highest end of the tier one penalties that he awarded for tier one? And then he would only be able to revisit whatever date we said recklessness was clear?
I think that would be right, Your Honor.
Okay.
Can I ask you a question about the basic liability finding and the role of state law?
Sure.
In the analysis? And so I would just, to take a hypothetical that's simpler than this case, you know, suppose you have a non-bank lender, so that there's no interstate dimension, you know, they're in California, and they make a loan, and it says, you know, here's the interest rate. And the interest rate exceeds the legal usury rate in the state. And then the loan comes due and they send a letter saying, you know, you owe us this money. Please give us the money. In your view, is that a violation of the federal statute?
It depends. It depends on whether the deception here was the cash call told consumers that they owed money that they did not actually owe. So in these states, state law actually rendered the loans void. There are lots of states that have usury limits that don't make loans void as a result. So consumers actually still owe the amount even though it exceeds the usury cap. So in your hypothetical, it would turn on whether the consumer owed the amount.
And the deception is, you know, the deception is in the failure to inform the consumer that state law provides that you don't really owe us this money? I mean, is that...
That would be a way of perhaps correcting the deception, but the deception is more straightforward. It's saying you owe me money when the truth is you don't owe me money.
So, I mean, suppose, you know, coming back to the facts of this case, if they had sent all of the consumers a letter that said, we told you that your contract is governed by the law of the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, which has no usury limit. But, you know, in fact, if you look at the second restatement of conflicts, it's probably actually governed by the law of your state. Would they then, I mean, would that eliminate the problem?
So there's case law about, you know, if you make a deceptive statement and can you cure it? And, you know, there, if it actually, I'm not sure that in your hypothetical this would cure the deception, but if before Cash Call collected any money from the consumers, they had made it clear that the consumers didn't actually owe the money. And so, you know, then we could know that the consumers were paying it sort of out of a voluntary sense of obligation or something, as opposed to in response to these deceptive statements, then, you know, we wouldn't be here. But
it does go to there's sort of a sliding scale, not only on kind of civil damages that we were talking about before, but also on the liability. Because at some point, I mean, it turned out to be wrong, but on day one, was that deceptive? I'm sure your position is it was absolutely deceptive on day one.
Absolutely. And a mistake of law is not a defense. Mistake of fact is not a defense. Congress did not see fit to include either of those defenses in the statute.
I get that, but businesses all the time make decisions based on risk analyses, and just because they end up being wrong at the end of the day, I'm not sure that that always exposes them to a consumer fraud claim. And that's what I'm struggling with here, is at some point it becomes untenable. And maybe here there's a decent basis that on day one it was untenable, because you're not drawn on a clean slate. You're kind of trying to transfer one position that already was found illegal, at least in certain states, with the bank, hiring a bank, to, okay, well, now we'll hire a tribe. And so maybe that supports that. But it does strike me that the liability, there's a sliding scale on how deceptive these statements were.
A couple of points on that, Your Honor. First, it's not a sliding scale on good faith belief or anything like that on the liability. Defendants haven't argued that. That is not an issue in this appeal. They have two challenges to the deception finding, at least as far as the companies are concerned, and that is not one of them. You know, the basic principle just harkens back to mistake of law isn't a defense. Mistake of fact isn't a defense.
But does it go into restitution? I read the district court to suggest that it sort of did play into the restitution analysis.
I think that's a fair reading. And again, you know, no, because that effectively reads a mistake of law or mistake of fact defense into the statute, where Congress didn't.
Well, I don't think it reads it into the statute. Restitution is permissive. It's not required. Civil penalties is required, but restitution is permissive. And so it strikes me that the district court can take that into account for purposes of restitution. He cites a good case that says, look, I can't consider the legal claims, the legal memos that you received for purposes of liability, but I can for restitution. And there's a Ninth Circuit case that suggests that he was right on that.
No, I don't think he could consider that, Your Honor, and here's why. It's well established that even if we're talking about sort of discretionary and equitable remedy, a court cannot deny that sort of relief for reasons that are incompatible with the underlying statute. And here,
you're talking about the Pantron case.
Pantron, Albemarle Paper. Albemarle Paper is perhaps the most on point there. That's the Supreme Court case. The lower court had denied an equitable remedy on the ground that the defendant.
The problem that I have with that reasoning, because I haven't looked at that second case, but I don't think Pantron supports it, which maybe is what you're suggesting here, doesn't support it that strongly, because if you took that position, then you'd always award restitution. It would almost become mandatory, because the purpose, of course, is to, you know, protect the consumer, and so you'd always have to give restitution.
The Supreme Court made a similar point in Mitchell. It said there's no doubt that the statutory purposes leave, quote, little room for the exercise of discretion to deny the relief. Even where the relief is a discretionary, equitable remedy, the discretion that the court has is bound by the purposes of the statute. And here, Congress enacted a very broad remedial scheme that was designed to ensure that there could be full compensation for victims of unlawful practices. And restitution has two purposes. It's supposed to compensate the victims, and it's supposed to make sure that the wrongdoer has to give up the proceeds of the unlawful conduct. So here, looking to bad faith is at odds with that. It is and this is the point that the Supreme Court makes in Albemarle Paper, it's converting the restitution remedy into a punishment for moral turpitude, but that's not what restitution is about. And that's why it is not consistent with this remedy that Congress established to look to a defendant's good or bad faith.
It is a little odd that you asked for $235 million in restitution and the district court says zero. I give you that. But part of what I think the district court was worried about, and he didn't state it this way, but was that he didn't feel like you, the government, met your burden here. And the government's position seems to be, hey, all we had to do was count up how much revenue they received, and that's it. That was all our burden was. But I don't read our cases to suggest that. If you read Commerce Planet, it says you have to reasonably approximate unjust gains, and that's that is defendant's net revenue. And that would put the government with the duty to go in and say how much was paid by the consumers, which you did, minus the refunds and chargebacks, which I didn't perceive the government to have done. And the government's position seems to be, hey, we're just going to tell you net revenues. We don't know about the rest of it. That's their job, Cash Call's job, to come back and rebut. And I'm not sure that that's my reading of the case law.
We did provide
okay.
For the
so the refunds. $235 million cuts out refunds and chargebacks.
Yes, it does. And you can see that in excerpts of record tab 280-1. That's where we provided the information about the refunds. So the $235 million figure that we requested, that was all the interest and fees that Cash Call collected minus the amounts that they had already refunded.
Under state law, most of these contracts were void, as I understand it.
All of them, yes.
Well, that's not what the district court says. He says most are void or have to be revised. And there's a difference there. So I think that's one of the things that the district court was struggling with, is the state law is not uniform on this. But I have a more fundamental question than that. What does it mean that they're void? If I give you a $3,000 loan and I'm charging you 150% interest, and state law says I cannot do more than 10%, and you say, this contract's void, do you get to keep, as the consumer, the $3,000 that I've given you, or do you have to give that back?
That is a question of state law, and in these states, these 13 states at issue in this action, the loans were absolutely void. The consumers had no obligation to pay anything.
Well, but did they have to give back the initial loan?
Under these state laws, no. And or at least for most of the states, they didn't have to give back the principal either. For some states, they did also have to give back the principal.
So you're saying I could go out and find somebody who's charging a high – man, this is actually interesting. I could go find somebody who's paying high – or charging me higher interest than is permitted, and I could go get the highest loan – that they would give me, and then I could write them a letter and say, I'm not going to pay you back, and tough luck, you can't do anything about it. Thanks for the $10,000.
If you're in one of those states,
yeah.
Then it seems like that is the state, well, two things. That may be the judgment that the state legislature has reached. Separately, there may be defenses like unclean hands in the hypothetical that you posit. But if you were an innocent consumer, then yes, that is the judgment that the state legislatures have made. And so we are just taking that state law as a given. And under these state laws, you know, I want to make clear at issue here, there's no dispute that if these consumers' home state laws apply, these loans are void and consumers had no obligation. That's not in dispute in this case.
Do you want to reserve?
Yes, please.
All right.
Good morning, Your Honors. I want to start on the restitution and just say that the CFPB got the exact trial it asked for. It agreed with the legal framework of that trial. It decided its own trial strategy on how to prove its case, how to convince the district court to award restitution. It was allowed to put on any witness it wanted to. It was allowed to cross-examine the defense witnesses without limitation, and none of its evidence was precluded from admission. After all of that, in a bench trial where the court is making findings of fact and the parties have agreed it is up to his discretion, the CFPB lost its restitution bid. The decision was based on findings of fact, for which there's no clear error, and the district court's sound discretion. The order denying the restitution should be affirmed.
That seems to be the problem, though, that the government's now saying there was clear legal error and that some restitution. It is sort of hard to understand how I read it to be that the district court was a little bit frustrated that the government came in and said $235 million is what we want. We're not deviating from that. And he sort of said, that's just too high. But there's a big difference. There's a lot of room between zero and $235 million. And so that's the concern that we have. I think that we need to look at is, was the district court, did he abuse his discretion, commit clear legal error in saying, I'm just not going to award any restitution at all?
Well, I think there's steps initial, Your Honor. I think that first the court is being asked to sit in equity and decide, is restitution appropriate in this case? The CFPB agreed with that framework. We agreed with that framework, and the district court did.
But why wouldn't it be? If consumers were defrauded, why isn't restitution the natural remedy?
Well, it's sitting in equity, and I don't think that the court concluded that they were defrauded. I don't think they were. I think that they concluded that they were deceptive, and I think Your Honor has already identified along the path of time, the district court decided when he issued his summary judgment order, which he recognized at the trial phase, that our clients did not know. They had legal counsel, but they did not know that they had been held, that they were acting deceptively under the CFPA until the district court's order. So when we get to the trial, and everyone agrees.
Back up. Is this the first? But this isn't the first judicial award. You don't, by the time the district court's order came down, what are you referring to? The district court's order in this case? Because you had already settled, or the cash call had already settled with several states, suggesting that they had been violating the law prior to the district court's order.
Well, I don't agree that that's the settlement, the reason for the settlement. I think that in any settlement, I think that you have an enforcement action has commenced. Both the state governments are deciding what they think is appropriate to give back to the consumers, and we're deciding to end the litigation. So I don't think it was conceded.
I'm not suggesting it was conceded, but I'm just pushing back on your statement that until the district court's order here, they had no idea that what they were doing was illegal.
Well, I don't think they did. To say they had no idea, obviously they had hired counsel to advise them whether it was legal or not. Their counsel along the way said, we think this is going to be defensible.
But until 2013, and then they withdrew that opinion and you stopped issuing loans under this arrangement.
Your Honor, respectfully, they did not withdraw the opinion. What happened was...
It's because you fired them before they could withdraw it.
No, I think that they consistently held that was the opinion. I think it got to a point, and I think the record shows that the Western Sky program was having an effect on the business's mortgage business. They heard from Fannie Mae, they heard from Freddie Mac, and they decided we're going to pull the plug. There's also a lot of civil actions, a lot of civil enforcement actions from the states. That's not a concession or a recognition that this is illegal. They continued to believe that it was legal.
Well, in those seven states where they settled, and maybe this was just part of the settlement, they agreed not to continue to collect on the outstanding loans. So that comes pretty close to a concession.
As part of a settlement.
I understand.
Again, and it may not be in the record, but we've all been around long enough to know that states pile on. You get one state, you get one CFPA who says, hey, we've got this, you know, theory we're going to roll out. The next thing you know, every state is piling on, even ones without these usury statutes. So, and some states did not pursue any enforcement action. Yes, Your Honor.
Can I go back to what you said a moment ago? I'm looking at ER 316-10 from Mr. Redham's trial testimony. And being asked about, you know, counsel having disavowed their legal opinions, and he said, you know, they seemed to be saying that they were withdrawing at some point their opinions. You know, next answer, you know, he was upset that she was backtracking on the things that she had said. So am I misunderstanding that?
My understanding of the record, Your Honor, is that while they looked like they were beginning to backtrack, once the next thing you know, you've got all these enforcement actions and they're piling up and there's a malpractice suit, which is not a part of this, but our client begins to think, hey, wait a minute. You're backing up and you're fired. I don't know. The record is not clear that they were going to retract it, or later on they said no. They said, we retract this. This has been illegal all along. That was not the evidence in the record. And as well, there were other people who had weighed in. There were other things forming the opinions in my client's mind, including Mr. Webb's counsel, including third-party counsels had looked at this, and including several professors. So, and I think the findings of fact at the restitution trial confirmed that in the district court's mind. It looked at all this evidence. No one called Ms. Calloway. It was our witnesses, and we were asked, and that's the record. And the court made findings of fact based on the testimony, Your Honor. I did want to go back to make a couple points to be helpful to the court. One, the state model was not held to be a problem until 2016. That is in the record. There were filings that were started before, but it wasn't until 2016. So, and on the reckless point, I think it's a great question.
Back up, the state model with regard to the tribes or the state model with regard to the hiring the bank?
I'm sorry, the banks. Right.
I thought there was a 2014 West Virginia Supreme Court case.
There was, you're right, Your Honor, there was. We disagreed with that, and that was in West Virginia, which is not a subject state. But then also, I also think that in 2016 was when the Maryland came. So I do apologize, Your Honor, it was 2014, but that is long after. And that model is different.
By the way, that to me just supports this idea that this should be a sliding scale. You know, that at some point it goes from tier one to tier two. I mean, how do you get around this to say that Redham, if I've said the name right, I hope, but that he was reckless for purposes of liability, but never reckless for purposes of tier two civil penalties?
Well, I think the distinction. And I think everyone in the courtroom has to look at it twice, but I've landed on this, that for liability, the court is looking at whether he was recklessly indifferent to the truth or the falsity of the misrepresentation. And that's the reckless standard he's looking at for liability. We think
well, right. Wrong. And so I know you think he's wrong, but he found that he was reckless as to the truth of the representation.
Right, because he wouldn't.
Yep. So how does that translate?
Because he decided that what was actually in his mind, the court wasn't going to consider, which was based on his legal opinion. On an issue of law, we asked, he's expecting a lay person to remove everything that the lawyers have put into his head. So we disagree with that. But on the reckless at the summary judgment stage versus the trial, the test at the for liability is at the summary judgment stage, reckless indifference to the truth or falsity of the misrepresentation. At the CMP stage, the civil money penalty stage, that question is whether they recklessly engaged in a violation, whether they recklessly violated the statute. I think that's what the court was trying to figure out.
Although he said nothing about anything that you just said.
Well, he's basing the standard. Yeah. You're right. He didn't articulate the difference, nor did the parties in the briefing really draw that out. But I think those are distinctions. They're reckless in his conduct at the liability stage, and then it's that you recklessly violated the CFPA. I recall that the district court held that he could not have known until the summary judgment stage that it had recklessly violated the CFPA. So that's why I think that there are two differences. And if we're going to collapse those anyway, which I don't think is the right read. I think what I just said was the right read. But if we're going to collapse them, then I think that you would weigh on the side of the trial, where the judge heard witnesses and got declarations and put witnesses on the stand and there were cross-examination, and then he came and said, well, he wasn't reckless compared to, let's go back to the summary judgment stage where there's just some papers filed in a very minimum standard. I think you would find that the findings of fact are the ones that are stronger.
What if we believe that he was reckless at some point, even for civil penalties? Would we try and come up with a date at which we think he was reckless, or would we say, listen, we don't know when he became reckless, and it should have transferred from tier one to tier two, and we'd remand it to the district court to make that determination, but just say, look, at some point, whether it was 2013, 14, 15, 16 by Maryland, whatever it was, at some point he became reckless, and we're going to demand that the district court find that he was reckless on some date.
I don't think so. I think that
you think we should just do it ourselves and figure it out.
No, the exact opposite. I don't think it's appropriate for this court. I think that this court is, when it's looking at the civil money penalty and whether someone, it was reckless, that is a factual finding for which there, I don't think there's clear error. And I think if you were to find there were clear error, I don't think you can find it on this record.
No, I understand that. I'm asking, I know I'm putting you in a tough spot. Assume that we believe that he was reckless at some point. Do you think it's our job to figure out on what date he became reckless, or do you think we would remand it to the district court to make that finding?
I don't think it's this court's role to make findings of fact. So, and that feeds to my answer before, but I think the court made its findings of fact, and there is no clear error, and it was his discretion.
Could I ask you,
the CMP. Yes, sir.
I'm sorry. Could I ask you to address the underlying liability question and the role of state law in the analysis? And you know, why isn't it a deceptive practice to tell consumers that they owe you money and need to pay you money when, under the governing law, which might be state law in some cases. They don't, in fact, owe you money.
Well, I think you have to. I think you have to start with whether or not Congress has. I think this is part of a trail, and I'll get to your question, Your Honor. I think you start with the principle that the Congress has to speak clearly if it wants to reach into state law. I think it has to be expressed. I think that's bond two. And I think that there is no such language here. As a matter of fact, there is opposite language. The usury prohibition, which we were able to argue on the papers, but we never got to argue before Judge Walter, I think it speaks very clearly that Congress did not intend. It did not want the CFPB going in and doing anything with usury limits. It says no provision of this title. It's not just talking about rulemaking. It's saying no provision of this title should be construed as conferring authority to establish a usury limit. So I think Congress has not only not given them to reach in down to state law, but I think they've also said don't go in this area. Now, the reason it's not deceptive is because there is no independent basis. No independent basis that they've said is deceptive. They've used the words and said, well, it violates the usury sandwich in these 13 states, so it's void, and thus we'll say it this way. We'll say it's unlawful to collect money you didn't owe. The entire theory rests solely on the usury statutes. That's why we don't see a lawsuit we don't see the complaint challenging other states. They're only picking the states that they can rely on those laws for.
But I mean, so deception, it seems to me, is sort of, you know, creating an impression in someone's mind that's not true. And the reason that the impression, you know, in this case, the impression is you owe us the money. And the reason that that's not true might be, you know, some fact that they don't know, or it might be the operation of some principle of federal law or some state law. And I don't see why why is state law special that when the untruthfulness is created by state law, we don't get to look at it.
Well, principles of federalism. I mean, I think that's our position. The Congress did not say anything that violates state law. You can say is unlawful or it's unfair or it's deceptive or abusive. I think if it was going to define those terms, which are loose terms, deceptive, unfair, abusive, and it intends for the government to go down and reach across the river of federalism and say, we're going to bring up all the state laws, so if you can find this, then you can say, well, it's deceptive to say something unlawful. I think it's as simple as that. I think it's simple as you're relying on state law for your deceptiveness. And I don't think that the statute calls for that. As a matter of fact, Your Honor, I think the statute says unfair, deceptive, or abusive or practice under federal law. Now, in the CFPB's brief, they said, well, under federal law, this is under federal law because it's deceptive, which means under 5531A, their reading is unfair, deceptive, or abusive or practice under federal law, which includes the law we just gave you. That doesn't make any sense to me. I think the reading of the statute is under federal law. You need to find something that's deceptive. They never argued that it was deceptive for another reason, that the terms were in a holograph, or the terms were hidden, or they weren't told.
Well, why isn't this like the courier case from the Sixth Circuit? I mean, I know that it's a different statute, but a similar prohibition. And there they said, you know, if you try to collect a debt by doing something that you're not allowed to do under state law, you know, it's not that the violation of state law is per se a violation of federal law, but it can be the basis for finding a violation.
Well, I think this case is more like the cases the Sixth Circuit's talking about. And reason being is Courier held that, or those cases held that a violation of state law is not a per se violation of the FTCPA. So let's understand that. The FTCPA does not say every state violation. And the particular provisions that are at issue in those FTCPA cases allow for state law. Section 1692F1 says, prohibits, quote, the collection of any amount unless such amount is expressly authorized by the agreement creating the debt or permitted by law. I think that invokes state law. It certainly doesn't say federal law, like what we have in the CFPA. And 1692E5, threat to take an action that cannot be legally taken. I think that's broad enough. It certainly isn't limiting. But those two provisions like that are not at issue with the CFPA. We're back to unfair, deceptive, or abusive under federal law. So I did want to go back and talk briefly about Albemarle Paper.
Can I ask a question along those lines? Well, maybe I'm hitting the other point, but if we assume that some restitution was warranted here, and I know that's the point you wanted to just address, but under Commerce Planet, we've said that the government's duty is to present evidence that reasonably approximates unjust gains. Do you agree that the government's evidence, the $235 million figure, was the amount that was paid by consumers minus refunds and chargebacks?
If you use those words, yes, but I don't think that's accurate. I don't think it reflects to say that they showed up and put up the net revenues. First, I would say that I think the case law, I think Gordon and Commerce Planet and all those cases, I think they mean it when they say you must reasonably approximate the defendant's unjust gains. There's a lot packed into there. You must reasonably approximate. That's not just show up or
well,
for summary judgment.
I agree with you. If I was reading that, but when you read the cases, it then defines it as the amount paid by consumers minus refunds and chargebacks.
Well, I think what it does is it says you have to reasonably approximate the defendant's unjust gains, and it says that you may be able to do it by showing revenue. It doesn't say it always is the case.
Assuming that the district court said, hey, restitution's warranted here, and the government put on $235 million, what would you do to discount that figure?
We did do that, as a matter of fact, and we pointed out numerous things that were problematic and not included in the 235 and not accounted for. And again, we're particularly talking about a matter of equity. I think that test, reasonable approximate unjust gains, is under an equitable relief umbrella. And it's saying unjust is a part equitable. So that test, in most cases, yes, where someone is selling
a product that isn't the product.
Right, rhinestones for diamonds.
Yep.
There's no debate that equity should fall in that favor, and there's no debate that all the money should be given back. The rhinestones are worthless. But, Your Honor, I know I'm about to cross the sidewalk. If I could just finish.
The Rubicon can be crossed here.
Okay. We did, at the trial, contest. It was 235 at trial. Now it's 997. They essentially conceded there's a pardon error. But through our witnesses and the cross-examination of their loan witness, we pointed out multiple problems with the now 197. The numbers didn't account for the payment status of the loans. It didn't account for windfalls. The scenario of we gave $3,000 and the borrower may pay back $300, they want to call it interest, and so $300 of interest needs to be given back. That's not equity. And remind us,
well,
we're
why
not.
Why isn't it equity? Because you guys set your client set up that plan where of that $300, I'll bet you 90% of it is interest payment. I mean, that's what you get when you get 150%
interest
rate loan.
I'm sorry. I think that requires them to be enforcing the usury statute. If they're going to go straight to, hey, the remedy for the usury statute is this, then they're enforcing the usury statute. They've disbanded that. They've said we're not doing
well,
that.
Well, but there's at some point, I mean, we're talking about restitution now, and at some point, it seems to me you go in and you say, listen, gave a $3,000 loan. We're going to recalculate this at some reasonable rate.
Agree. And that's not what
And
they
what
did.
Would that amount have led to? If that analysis had gone through, was that like $90 million?
I don't know what the number is. It's varying. It would be varying amounts based on all the factors. So there's that. That's a point that they didn't account for. Yeah. And again, I think it's important to say we're sitting in equity. I don't think it's fair to say we didn't know that the loan wasn't enforceable. We had advice. Otherwise, we get to a point where we say, ta-da, it's deceptive and they weren't enforceable, and the person gets $300.
All right. So I know we're on borrowed time. I do have one more question, though, okay. And maybe others do as well. But what's the practical impact here? Does Cash Cal have $200 million they can even pay this back? Does Redham have $200 million?
I can't answer the Cash Cal. I think it's probably easy to say it does not. I would be shocked if Mr. Redham did. I mean, the idea, the 197, the $243 million was walked back at the trial. I think that's important to understand. It's not as simple. And I gave you a couple examples. I have a whole list.
I give you that.
Yeah.
But I think the trouble is, should it be zero? And that is difficult, I think. And so if it's not zero, then what do we do with it? And part of that seems to me to be, what even makes sense? I mean, if we're just talking about random figures that nobody can ever pay, does it really matter? I mean, is there $10 million that's accessible? Well, that's covered by the civil penalties. Is there $50 million that's accessible? I mean,
a lot has been paid back already through all these state settlements. So,
what is that, like $30
million? No, much more than that. I don't know the exact number off my head, but that is much
But
more
that
than
was already that. Discounted off of the...
They took it off, but those were also settlements. Some of them were intended to resolve the matter. I mean, these state AGs are sitting there saying, we've got to get what we think is fair or okay. reasonable for them. The $10 million, I mean, they lost money. I think it's important to understand that. Cash Call lost money on the ordeal. And then this $10 million, that's not a small amount of change. That's a lot of money. That's a lot of money. And a lot of these borrowers wanted these loans. Some of them were repeat borrowers, and a lot of them didn't pay back as much as even they took. So there's a whole list of things that were not configured that do play into the equity. So,
thank you, counsel, very much for your argument.
Way over. Thank you so much.
No, it's all right.
A few points on the restitution amount. The proper amount of restitution is the interest and fees that the consumers paid that they didn't owe. Those were all unjust gains because they were amounts that Cash Call told them they owed when they didn't owe it. The defendants are claiming that they lost money on this endeavor, but they lost money because it was an expensive business, and it's well established that you don't get to deduct things like your overhead costs, your cost of hiring employees, your cost of obtaining financing. That would effectively shift your cost of doing business onto the consumer.
What does it mean? Say you have a $200 million judgment. I get it. We're defending the principle here. It's perhaps a message to future actors. But does the government really think they can pay back $200 million?
At trial, they expressly disclaimed any reliance on seeking mitigation of the civil penalty amount based on lack of financial resources. So
they can pay $10 million or $50 million, presumably.
I don't know what their finances are, but you know, certainly that would be something to figure out once the appropriate judgment is entered. On this bad faith question, bad faith is just not a basis for denying or reducing a restitution award because that is inconsistent with the purposes of restitution. The Supreme Court made that point in Albemarle Paper. This court made that point in Virts v. Malthor. Bad faith can be relevant in two ways. One, if you act in bad faith, that sort of shuts the door to equity. The court made this point in Albemarle Paper. So if you act in good faith, that opens the door for other equitable considerations to come in and reduce an award. However, if you act in bad faith, you can't rely on any other factors. Bad faith is also a factor under the Act for civil penalties. The civil penalty provision of the Act expressly makes a defendant's good faith or bad faith a relevant consideration. So that does come into the remedial questions. It just does not come into restitution. I see I'm out of time. Do you have any more questions?
Right on the money. All right. Thank you very much, counsel, to both of you for your arguments in this case. I thought all the counsel today were very good, so I appreciate that. This matter is submitted, and we are in recess.